Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Hello, my name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each and every week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 348, Marilyn Modinger expanding her role as an architect by selling custom designed retail products. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more, and Monograph, the time tracking and project management tool built for architects by architects. Marilyn Modinger, welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
It is great to have you here, my friend. Marilyn, it has been a while. It's been a while since you've been here. You've been on the podcast before. You joined us back in episode 224. Where you shared your story and your lessons learned as an architect and a competitive power lifter. And that was a great episode. I had a lot of fun about that. You know, when people look at you, they don't think power lifter. And it's a great story and some really, really powerful lessons shared in that episode. So I highly recommend people go back and listen to episode 224, learn all about that part of Marilyn's life and what she's doing there. But that's been a while. That's been over 100 episodes. I'd like you to go back to sharing your story. But before we do that, let me do a little bit of an intro, give people a little bit of a background on who you are, and then you can dive deeper into who you are and where you've come from. Marilyn is the founding principal of Runcible Studios, based in the Boston, Massachusetts area. It's not in Boston, right? It's just outside of Boston?
Correct, yeah. But, you know, close enough.
Yep. Like the Runcible spoon, Marilyn is happiest operating at the seams between practicality and whimsy, utility and beauty, the esoteric and the mundane. Deeply passionate about the capacity for design to affect positive change in the world, Marilyn's interest in all aspects of housing, the connections between urban and rural life, the construction process, justice in the built environment, and the overlaps among disciplines, methodologies, and practices fuels Runcible Studios' mission to be nimble, rigorous, curious, fun, and meaningful. I love that intro, by the way. Really.
Thanks, Mark.
Well done. So before we jump into what you're doing today at Runcible, there's lots going on there since our last episode. I'd like you to provide some context, go back to your story, your origin story, share that with our listeners. I'd like to know when you discovered your passion for architecture and what or who inspired you to become an architect.
Well, I think it would be interesting to compare my origin story as I'm telling it now with my origin story as I told it in the past episode, which I didn't listen to before this. So we can compare and see if they're the same. Ever since I was little tiny, I've always wanted to build things. And I grew up on a farm. There was lots of room to build and explore and make forts and that kind of thing. And on rainy days, drawing, you know, you can draw the worlds that you imagine. And I never really knew, I didn't know any architects. I didn't know anybody who did that kind of work growing up. And it wasn't until well into high school that someone pointed out that there was a job, a career that I could do that involved drawing and buildings and all of that. I don't know why I didn't really put it together before then. When I took a career aptitude test, it said that my top two potential careers were actress and car mechanic. So I guess if you put those two together, you get architect. I don't know.
Actress plus car mechanic equals architect.
I don't know. Like, what was that? So anyway, but I started to look at architecture schools, and I remember going to, as a junior in high school, going on the college, you know, looking at colleges with my parents and walking into studios for the first time and seeing what studio education was all about and feeling like I had come home. Like, these were my people. This was this is how my brain worked. You know, the rigorous engineering side and also the artistic side, the maker, the figure it out, the creator side of me. So I went to architecture school and loved it so much. I just loved it so much. And then after that, went into construction. So right out of school, I got a job as a laborer in construction, and feel very lucky that my parents, my mentors, my friends were supportive of that decision. I'm not sure that everybody might would have been, but they were.
What inspired that move? I mean, because that's not a typical thing coming out of architecture school to go into construction. Some architecture students do that. I worked construction throughout architecture school, but why that choice rather than going into an architecture firm?
Well, my fourth year of undergrad, I was involved in a project called EcoMod, which used to be housed at University of Virginia where I went to school, but is now at University of New Mexico. And that project, we designed and built a house as fourth year students. So there were fourth years and then there were grad students as well. And that house was modular. It was affordable. It was an affordable house. Very sustainable, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was just bitten by the bug to build things. It was captivating to be able to draw something in the studio and then that afternoon go out to the field and try to build the thing we had drawn. And wow, did we learn a lot? We learn a lot about what lines mean on paper versus what they mean in the field? And I just felt like I had a lot more to learn. And the best place to learn that was in construction. So I kind of saw, I ended up working in construction for 4 years and worked my way out of the field and was an estimator, project manager, all that kind of stuff, you know, running jobs myself for a larger contractor. And I really just saw it as a continuation of my education. Plus it was really fun.
when you went into construction, was it the plan to work construction, learn what I need to learn from there, gather and grab what I can from that part of the industry and then move into architecture? Or when you did that initially, you thought, I like construction. I like building things. I'm going to just go do that instead.
I think one hallmark of the way that I look at my life and my career is that I don't see anything as permanent. So when I went into construction, it wasn't like, this is a career change that I'm making. I was 22, you know, and I also didn't see it as, this is a thing I will do for X number of years, learn X number of information, you know, things and this kind of information, and then go to grad school. There was no plan. It was these are the things I'm interested in, and this is the world where I can learn that stuff. And when it got to the point where I felt like I had learned a lot and I was ready to go back to grad school, then I went to grad school. But it sounds like I had this grand plan when you sort of look back over how my career has played out, but it definitely was not a grand plan. It was about any time I was curious about something, I wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I wanted to not just do it for a month, but do it for years and figure out exactly how it worked. But yeah, nothing's permanent. And that's how I look at my business too. Nothing's permanent. Yeah. Just give it a try. See what
I was
happens.
Going to say that as we get into this episode, you'll learn that not much has changed.
That's true.
All right. So you went into construction. After construction, you went into grad school. Where'd you go for grad school?
I was at University of Virginia also for grad school. Yep.
And then, so take it from there. What happened from there?
So after, I graduated in a recession, so that was scary. But so I had a job offer in Boston, a city that I had been to once in my life when I was like 11. And so I moved here sort of sight unseen. It wasn't much of a job offer. I had to move here and sort of be available. And then if the job materialized, then I would get to take it. So it all worked out in the end, but it was a little scary. So I was actually teaching also. I got an adjunct position at Northeastern. So I was teaching studio, and I had also won the SOM prize my final year in grad school. So the year after I graduated grad school, I packed up my whole life, moved to Boston where I knew nobody, took a teaching job for the first time in my life, took half a job at an architecture firm, and spent 18 months traveling the world in between everything and writing a book. So it was a little, it was intense, but it was really fun. So once the dust sort of settled from all of that, I was working for a firm here in Boston called Util, which in those days was like 18 or 20, and now they're up to like 60 people. So we were doing housing, really just great quality work. I learned a lot, made a lot of really good friends and connections there, who are still valued friends and colleagues today. And then I decided to take a job in academia. So I completely switched around and became an administrator at the at Boston Architectural College. I was the director of practice instruction there, and was in charge of all the sort of design, build, and community engagement projects. So while I was there, we did, it was like 60 or 80 projects with students, connecting groups of students up with local nonprofits to do semester-long design projects or design, build projects. Sometimes we could stretch the projects to be several semesters so students could continue to work on them. The idea being that nonprofits need design help and students need real world experience. So we kind of created this way for students to get that experience. So again, that was great. What's interesting though is that I took that job. I loved writing curriculum. I love the students. I love all that stuff. But I'm a builder. I'm an architect. So I again, nothing's permanent. So I felt, you know, that was a very interesting time for me to make lots of connections and learn about a lot of different things that are adjacent to our industry. And now one of my biggest source of referrals is former students. So yeah. I know lots of people at lots of different firms because they're all my former students. Then I decided that I had three more exams to go till I was licensed, and I was burnt out from how hard I was working as an administrator. And I basically just quit one day without a plan. So when people say, how did you start your business and you saved up and you did this? And I was like, well, I just sort of started by accident. I finished my exams, took some time to rest and to do some odd jobs that I had kind of lined up already. And next thing you know, I had a real job or two, and I thought, well, I better get some insurance and I better get an LLC going. And that was 6.5 years ago. So I realized I had a going concern about a year later. And I better make this real. So Runcible Studios has been up and running for about 6.5 years now.
That's where I remember meeting.
Yeah.
Right around there.
Yeah.
You've been an active member at Entree Architect from the very beginning. You've been a facilitator for many, many years, one of the original facilitators, one of the founding members. And so, yeah, I've watched the whole progress of Runcible, and it's been fun to watch.
Well, and Mark, you were a Twitter friend. We met on Twitter, I remember. And when you were starting Entree Architect and when all that was starting, I was like, yes, please let me in. I need help. What's going on? So, I mean, Entree Architect has been absolutely integral in my small group, which has been together for over 3 years now, 4 years, something like that. Just couldn't do it without them. So feel very lucky to have that. Have you guys as a resource.
Yeah, I'm very proud of you for your progress.
Thanks.
To see where you've come from and to see where you are today, the leadership you've given to other architects inside and outside of Entree Architect is commendable, and I appreciate you for all of that.
Thank you, Mark. That means a lot.
You're welcome. So you started your firm, and what happened from there? Struggled a little bit getting it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like to say I was profitable from day one, but that's because I made a lot of life decisions that made me profitable, like take on an extra roommate and turn the living room into a bedroom and rent out my driveway as parking spots and, you know, all sorts of weird ways, to bring my expenses. If you bring your expenses down enough, then you're profitable without bringing in much money.
Steve Wintner says all the time, he says, every dollar of expense is one less dollar of profit.
That's right. So that's how I was profitable early. And I was teaching a lot, honestly. So teaching as an adjunct here in the Boston area, there's a ton of schools. So that was very helpful to have teaching in the early days, especially. And eventually then teaching became a choice and not something that I was doing to put food on the table and pay the rent and that kind of stuff. So eventually I ran the shop for about 2 years on my own completely, ran it out of a co-working space with a hot desk for $300 a month. So no rent, you know, just keeping it really, really slim. And then I knew who I wanted to hire for like 8 months. Like I knew exactly who I wanted to hire. He's a friend and colleague from another firm that I had worked at. And I just knew that I wanted him. I knew he was the right one. So I courted him for about 6 months and saved up a bunch of money and told him that I had his salary saved. And it was a huge risk coming to me, but I really, really wanted him. And he's still here. That was 4.5 years ago. So thanks, Jason.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that too.
That was a big decision.
I think you and I had some one-on-one conversation about that.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things about that is that I hired him. He's all but licensed. I mean, he's just not licensed by choice, but you know, that was an important thing that you and I had talked about is to hire the most expensive person you can afford, or maybe even more expensive than you can afford. So many people told me hire an intern, they're cheap. But the conversations we had about it and in my group that we had, it was the opposite. It was hire someone who you can give chunks of work to so that you can do other stuff. And I have learned that lesson. It's just so, so, so important to hire. Your early hires should be expensive people. I will shout that from the rooftop.
Yeah. And that's very hard to do in the moment with that first move, right? Because you're taking a risk from the beginning. Bringing on anybody, right? Because you never have enough money. That's why you're hiring.
That's right.
Because you need to make more money and you maxed out doing your own solo gig. And so you need to hire somebody and you can't hire somebody who has no experience because then all of the work that you're doing has to now spend that time on somebody who's inexperienced.
Yep.
And it is important to hire those interns and inexperienced people, but not your first hire.
That's right. And I think interns are often better served by working somewhere a little bit more established or a little bit larger so that they can have people who do have time to mentor them. I mean, especially in those early days or even now as a small firm architect, I don't have tons of time to do the things that I would want to do to mentor someone who's coming up or spend time to really sit down and teach them what they need to know because I'm running around all the time. So, I think that's important for both the business and for the intern, for the profession, you know, for bringing up, you know, good interns.
Yeah. So where are you now with the business?
So now, well, I'll give a snapshot pre-COVID because I think that that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's move. Let's roll up to where where COVID, and then.
Yeah, we can talk about February 1st.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had rented my first real office space about a year and a half ago. That was not a co-working space. That was not my second bedroom in my rental. That was all that kind of stuff. It was really fun. And I was sharing space with Hourglass Boston, which is an awesome organization, supporting artists here in the Boston area and doing all sorts of super cool stuff. And we were sharing space, but it wasn't quite the right space. And our lease was coming up. And so we were looking for another space, and we found this space I'm in now, which is kind of a weird anomaly space. So we're in this like ramshackle converted garage kind of thing right now. And we had just moved in. We moved in February 1st. You know, the boards were full. I had just hired another person, really high level registered person. Like, I was looking to hire two more. I had never felt more secure.
Yeah.
And where things were going, we had several jobs out of state. We had really cool stuff lined up, work that was well underway.
It was finally all clicking and rolling and
all coming together.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the scariest moment I've learned, when you're like, yeah, okay, all right, I got this. Like, that's the moment. But usually if something happens to kind of reset you, it's something like, oh, you know, a job slows down, or you know, something happens. It isn't that a global pandemic sets in.
Right. The world shuts down literally for 3 months.
Yeah. So it was a really exciting point to be at. You know, I was spending money setting up more workstations and getting ready. And then, you know, here in Boston, we got hit early and we got hit really hard. So mid-March, I was teaching. We went all online mid-March. As the students were coming back from spring break. So that was really intense. And I was teaching professional practice. So that was interesting, having that, all these are grad students getting ready to graduate, and we're talking about their job offers are being rescinded and they don't know what's going on. And then, you know, the bottom really dropped out. We lost all of our work that was related to hospitality, retail, industrial. We're pretty involved in those sectors, and it was all gone within like 2 weeks. My clients who stopped those projects were wonderful. I just want to say they paid me for all the work that we did. They were just wonderful. And I understood the position they were in. They understood the position I was in. And, you know, as a side note, it's taken years and it's something I'm most proud of, to develop the projects that have those kinds of clients, that it wasn't always the case for us, but we just have this amazing slate of clients. And I think that's taken a lot of time and effort to get the kind of clients that that treat us right, and that we, you know, that there's mutual respect and all that kind of stuff. So they were really wonderful, but it was pretty tragic. And I was suddenly looking at my bigger office space with more rent, my very expensive new employee, and this is a common story that many people have gone through. And we basically closed down the office, everybody moved home. And I just, that day it was sort of snowing and we closed the office, and I locked the door, and I'm like holding my computer in my hands, and I started to tear up. I was like, I was so close. And I don't know what's happening now. I'm like going home to sit in my hallway like the old days. Like, I thought I was past this. I was so close. And now I'm like sitting in the hallway with a space heater, like trying to run an architecture office through a pandemic. So it was pretty abrupt around here. How it happened. And it was really scary. I mean, we had mask mandates right away and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, everyone was just trying to help each other and trying to figure out what was going on.
I think
it was pretty tough.
And it took probably 3 months or so to sort of realized that it wasn't temporary, right? Yes. I think that sort of throughout the nation, it was sort of this, oh, this, we'll just stop doing this for a couple of months and then we'll be right back. And then we realized, oh, this is going to be longer, but you know, it'll be a few more months and we'll be right back. And oh, maybe it'll be a year and we'll be right back. And I think somewhere during the summer, I think many people realized this is a long-term semi-permanent situation that we have to adjust to and adjust personally. And we have to start looking at our businesses this way and start to make some changes and look at other opportunities and do all the things that we need to do in order to run our businesses. We will return to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, RCAT, and Monograph. RCAT.com has been assisting architecture professionals in their search for the best products for their projects for nearly 30 years. Starting as a printed desktop reference with listings in manufacturers' catalogs, RCAT has evolved into the number one most used website for finding building product information. Today, RCAT is an invaluable tool for AEC professionals, offering a powerful product search engine that's backed up by up-to-date CAD, BIM, and specifications. And just as it was in 1991, today, RCAT offers all of this at no cost to their users and without requiring any registration. It's free. Visit entrearchitect.com/RCAT today and see why architecture professionals have leveraged the power of RCAT for three decades. entrearchitect.com/RCAT. That's entrearchitect.com/ARCAT. Spreadsheets. Spreadsheets. Are you tired of using spreadsheets to keep track of your project plans, your budgets, your staff, your time? Our friends at Monograph know what that's like because they're architects too. They know all about that spreadsheet mess that you're dealing with. So they did something about it. Monograph is a time tracking and project management tool built for architects by architects to respond to the challenges that small and medium-sized firms face on their quest to a profitable business. With Monograph's integrated suite of tools, you'll stay on track and on budget without the overhead of wrangling spreadsheets every day. Improve your firm's operations today. Try Monograph. Try it for free at entrearchitect.com/monograph. Ditch the spreadsheets. Visit entrearchitect.com/monograph and try Monograph right now for free. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Did you have similar experience?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think my one thing that happened pretty early on was, you know, work is important to me. I like working hard. I like problem solving. I like working hard physically. Like that's important to me and feels good. So in the face of an emergency, I want to know, okay, what can I do? What can I build? What can I, you know, how can I help? Like where's the problem and how can I dive in and help? And the problem that immediately came to light here in Boston was lack of PPE. We were getting emails from hospitals saying, we have nothing if you have something in your garage. I mean, it was apocalyptic. It just felt unreal. So I said, well, I know how to sew. So I got out a sewing machine and got in touch with some folks who were already doing mask making and volunteered to make masks. And that first batch, I made 8 and it took me like 4 or 5 days. and I was like rusty and I didn't know quite how to do it. And everything was hard. And plus the psychological part, I'm making masks, like this is so weird. But then after that, you know, I ramped up production and I was making masks for donation about 30 to 40 hours a week. So on top of working in the office 60 to 70 hours a week. So there was a span of about 8 to 10 weeks where I was 90 to 100 hours a week working in the business. And then I would get up at 5, I would sew for 2 hours, I'd go into the office, AKA the other room, And I eventually, as I mentioned, we share space with Hourglass Boston, and they were trying to figure out how to support artists and get PPE where it needed to go at the time too. And we were brainstorming about how we could work together on that. And I remember saying to Nicole, who runs Hourglass, I said, "Hey, what if we just sold masks on your website?" Like they have a store, and I said, "Well, why don't we just try it?" And we put up, I think, 20 masks, and they sold out in like 4 minutes. so we were like, whoops. So I guess maybe this is a thing. So I started producing masks, and she would buy them for me and then sell them on her site, marked up. So we were both getting paid. I was buying all my material locally, from a shop that was down the street, but that I couldn't go into because everything was closed. So they would deliver me fabric in brown bags on my porch. And then, I would, sew and drop, individually package them and drop them off remotely to Nicole, who would put them on her site, and then she would mail them out. And that was wild. We had a spreadsheet saying, you know, here are the different designs, here's how many we anticipate selling, here's what we're doing. Then we got started having fun with it and started doing fun photo shoots with them and, like, you know, having people do these cool selfies with them. And then, of course, because I'm a honestly, that brought in real money. That brought in real money. That paid me that month. That paid my salary. That, I mean, a reduced salary, but it paid me that month.
It covered your expenses.
Yep. And, you know, of course, I'm an architect, so I can't leave well enough alone. So I was like, there's got to be a better way to make these masks. These ear loops kind of hurt, you know, like there's got to be a better way. So I started experimenting.
Just before you get into that, because you're an entrepreneur architect.
Oh, right. I'm an entrepreneur architect.
That's why that's happening.
That's true. That is very true. That's an important distinction.
It's both. Yes. It's both sides of you that saw that and realized there needed to be more.
Innovation. There was room for innovation. Yep. So I started experimenting with different materials, and I was on Etsy, like buying all this. So any money that I was like making, quote unquote, I was spending on new weird materials, trying to figure out like better ways to make the mask. And then I would wear them out and get people's reactions or test them and see what was comfortable or what wasn't. And ended up landing on a new behind the head design that's made out of a shoelace. So I found this company in Atlanta that was selling shoelaces that are stretchy. And then I bought a toggle and put it on the back, and so they're adjustable. So I started selling those on my website, which didn't have a store or anything. But I was like, oh, well, my website's a Squarespace site, so it has the store plugin for an extra $10 a month or whatever it was. And I said, well, what else am I doing? I'm working 100 hours a week. I might as well like see what the store is about. So I thought, why don't I just try this? So I put my masks up and marketed them separately from the ones we were selling at Hourglass, because these are the behind the head ones and they were different designs. And people were into them. So I was still making masks for donations, still making masks for Runcible, or still making masks for Hourglass, and then I was making masks for Runcible.
That's a lot of masks.
It's a lot of masks.
Were you doing that all yourself, or did you have help at that point?
I was doing it almost all by myself. James, who was working for us at the time, he was making masks for donations. So he made, I think he made about maybe like 50 for donation, something like that. And my count is up, donation and the ones I've sold, I'm over, it's like 1700, I think, that I've made.
Wow.
Yeah, I can make I've got a whole system. There's an assembly line. There's a whole system.
And you're still practicing architecture.
I'm running the business. Yeah.
Didn't shut down the architecture studio to do this new business. You're doing this together.
Why not? I mean, there did come a point where I did kind of shut down. I was so exhausted that I did have to take a step back and say, okay, well, 100 hours a week is not sustainable. it's not okay. And, you know, I realized it was also kind of an emotional reaction to an emergency, is to dive in and work as hard as I can. And that's fine, but it's not an emergency. This is now life. As you were saying, this is now what life is. So I have to really readjust everything. And if I want to do all this stuff, I have to really readjust so that I can do this in, you know, 50 to 60 hours a week and not, I'm very committed to not working 100 hours a week. That's not right. That's not okay. I had to give up powerlifting during that whole time. And you know, that wasn't okay. So I did have to make a major readjustment and say, hey, if you want to do all this stuff, then you've got to change some things.
So what did you do at that point where you realized I'm making a big difference here? I'm making a lot of masks. I'm making some money. I like what I'm doing. I'm helping. But this is not sustainable. This is, I'm going to crash eventually. And this, no, then nobody's any good, right? You're no good. Right. The people you're helping won't be helped anymore. So when you were at that moment, what did you do? And then what were some of the changes that you made?
So I recognized, it's always good to, when you're head down, you're working really hard, to like lift your head up for a minute and look around like prairie dogs or meerkats or whatever, like they stand up and they look around for a minute and just get a lay of the land. And I realized that many people by this point were making masks for donation, and also PPE production had caught up. So I could still make them for donation, but I wasn't needed as much as I was before. So I backed off on that. You know, I'll still make masks for donation if requested, or if somebody needs one, I'm happy to give them one. But by that time things had caught up and people were, so that kind of went away on its own. At the office, you know, so much of our work had slowed down that, you know, and so much of it had just gone away that we weren't as busy at the office. We had some work that was, we had one particular project that was very steady, and we were pinch hitting for another architect in Philly working for them. And so that was an easy one. Oh, by the way, we were also learning Revit as an office during this. So it was like, well, hey, like we've got this project, you know, let's just give it a try. You know, let's focus in, let's try to learn Revit in these times. And, you know, I'll take the odds and ends. And we had two projects that were wrapping up construction, and I could sort of see that I wasn't getting the number of inquiries I usually get. I wasn't, you know, and I sort of did the math. I said, okay, what do I need to do to make it through 2020? Like, what do I need to do? And I basically figured out that at starvation rate, like keeping everyone's pay the same, but spending not an extra penny anywhere, being really careful, making sure to stay on top of invoicing, that with our current, this was midsummer as I figured this out, that we would make it to the end of the year. I didn't know what would happen in January, but I knew we would make it to the end of the year. So that gave me enormous peace of mind. And once I knew that, then I had the freedom to not be so frantic to chase work or to take bad work. And I learned that lesson so acutely before, that taking bad work is never worth it.
Yeah.
That I wasn't tempted to take bad work. And I think that is very different than me 3 years ago or 4 years ago at the very beginning, taking crappy work because I'm scared of not being able to pay people.
Yeah.
So I didn't take bad work. I stuck with the work we had and worked really hard to make sure we were sticking with it. So some of it happened naturally. And then some of it was, you know, and then, you know, some oddball things happened, like James, who was working for us, who I'd hired in February, went back to grad school. So, you know, that helps the old bottom line. And I decided not to rehire at this time. I would love to rehire. I would have loved if he would have stayed. But I would, you know, but at the same time, I decided not to rehire and let that. That was a big help to have a payroll cut a little bit. So a couple of those things kind of came into focus and that helped.
So you evaluated your situation, the meerkat popped up, looked around, wait a minute, this, I can make some changes here and still benefit the people that I need to benefit. I can still focus on the things I want to focus. Then there were a few things that because of the condition and the situation that we're in, sort of made changes for you, right? And you took advantage of those and not rehired those. And so you have some opportunities for additional or fewer expenses, which, you know, helps your bottom line. And then so now at this point, are you sort of have the plan for the rest of the year and know where you're going and what you're doing for the next few months?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. We've got work lined up that's solid that we're excited about. We've also got my most recent project, which is another out. In addition to the meerkat popping up and looking around and seeing what was going on, I also needed to evaluate how to keep myself going through all of this. Our Entree Architect Mastermind group met every week, sometimes for extra meetings, throughout this whole time, and was a huge support system through that. And also it became clear to me that I needed to find other things to kind of keep me going and keep me fueled and excited and hopeful. And the mask adventure, putting the mask on my website, was part of that. So I decided to try selling other things on my website. and so this was a late summer development that I thought I would give a try. We put up our first round of t-shirts and sweatshirts and things. We have a line of they're drop ships, so I don't have to stock everything. So they're custom printed for each person who orders it. And I thought I wanted to have something that reflected our values at Runcible and my sort of spirit around building. So we have a couple of different ones. One says, "I can build that," with a period at the end.
Yeah.
I can build that. As I thought about what our world is going through, and you know, I should also say that during this time, as we were experiencing, the sort of next iteration of civil rights as it was happening here in Boston and throughout our country, we took active part in those movements, came out very strongly in support of Black Lives Matter. And as part of that, I started to think about what it meant to take a stand about my values as a person and as a business owner. And the phrase, "I can build that," really meant a lot, really encapsulated a lot. It reminded me of being 5 years old and building my fort. You know, I can build that. I can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
It reminded me of what I heard community leaders and people that inspire me saying about the kind of world they wanted to build, the kind of just society. You know, we can build that. I can build that.
Yeah.
Everyone is a builder in one way or another. And even in times where things are very unsure or where things are coming to light that that are systemic and that are problematic in our world, that we need to change. So that's where that came from. So we have our "I can build that," and then we have our "I heart buildings." So I thought, you know, what am I always saying? I'm like, I love buildings. I just do. So we tried that out. It was really fun. And then the other design was a list of women of architecture. So I started to think about who are the women who've paved the way in this field. And it started off, we did a whole series this summer on social media, a series of stories showcasing pioneering Black architects. It reminded me of these names that I had and these people that I had learned about before, and that I wanted to sort of bring back into our consciousness. So I started with a list of women architects, and I was nervous to make a shirt that had this list of names because I would forget someone or someone would say, you should have put this person and not that person. And I welcome that kind of commentary and that kind of conversation. So what I tried to solve it. I think I solved it by leaving a blank at the bottom. So there's the list of names, and then it says, and then there's a line. So you can add someone else that has inspired you, or maybe yourself or someone that you know. So we have note cards and tote bags and t-shirts and all sorts of stuff. So I guess I now am a clothing designer or a t-shirt designer. I don't know.
Yep. You could add that to the list. Clothing designer, fashion designer, retail mogul.
Yeah, that's the plan. So they're all up there. We're getting ready for our next big drop of cool, probably when this podcast goes up, we'll have our whole new line up. The next line is all inspired by architectural drafting symbols. So we have door swings and beds and tables and, you know, all sorts of weird things. The idea being that I wanted to create some graphic tees that were cool, that architects might think were, they understood the deeper joke, but non-architects would be like, that's a cool design. So now we have a whole line of t-shirts and all sorts of designs, and we've been doing photo shoots, Mark, like these super fun photo shoots with all kinds of fun artists and collaborators, and it's been really fun. So that's part of it. It's about, obviously it's there to help us be profitable and help us make money as a business, but it's also there because it's a wonderful way for us to work with other artists, collaborate in ways that allow us to funnel money towards the art community here in Boston.
And spread a very, really positive, powerful message while you're at it.
Yeah, that's the hope. So that's what we're doing. I'd love for everyone to go buy t-shirts, but I'm also just excited to have gone through the process and to be tinkering with it. We're having fun with it.
Yeah. So people can go right now. Runcible Studios.com/shop is where you can go to check out the whole collection, the Modinger collection, the fall 2020 Modinger and Runcible collection. Runcible Studios with an S.com/shop. What a wonderful journey you've had, Marilyn. I love how everything that is presented to you, you embrace it, you analyze it, you deal with it, you get through it, and then you proceed and progress. You make it into something bigger and better and more powerful and more positive. You are a role model for architects throughout the world. They should go check out runcible studios.com and see what you do. They should definitely connect with you on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn. Definitely connect with Marilyn on Twitter at MW Modinger. Personal Twitter feed, very powerful messages that you're sharing there. So they should definitely connect with you there. Before we wrap up, Marilyn, I'd like you to answer the one question that I ask everybody here. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, I think I'll share a quick story. As I mentioned that we're in this space, we're sharing with Hourglass Boston. We're also sharing with another important collaborator in here, Jay Birdie Fitness, who happens to be my roommate. Jessie Burdick happens to be my roommate, and she's a strength and conditioning coach. And she had to start her business during the pandemic because she lost her other positions at gyms. We pulled together a bunch of equipment, but she didn't have anywhere to go. Well, I looked around and said, why this big old office space with a giant conference room? Why don't you take over the conference room? So now we've got an artist group, an architecture firm, and a powerlifting gym in one space. And we're all socially distanced. We're doing it all the right way, contact tracing, all that good stuff. But I share this story because what's the one thing you can do? find the things and the people that fuel you and that make you excited and that make you want to do your work. You know, who says that you can't put a powerlifting studio next to an artist space, next to an architect space? Who says you can't? Nobody says that. Or if they do, ignore them. You know, it's not, who said that you can't start a retail store if you want to? I think so many times as architects, we stop ourselves. We don't ask, how many times have you put together an invoice and you say, oh, well, I shouldn't ask for that much, so I'm going to take money off of it before somebody else told you to.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Finding things that fuel you, that keep you excited, that don't say no to yourself before you've even tried something, before, you know, nothing's permanent. It doesn't matter. The shop doesn't work. Okay, that was fun, you know. At some point, will there be other people in this space? Or maybe a year from now, we won't all be here. Okay, but we have this wild, wonderful story of these three businesses that are making it happen in this weird way. And so I think it's just what you can do is fuel your curiosity, find things that feed you, and don't be afraid. It's scary, but you don't have to be afraid. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It's okay.
Very,
because sometimes it will work and it'll yeah. be awesome.
and usually it will work.
Usually
that's
it
the
does.
Thing
yeah.
is that if you're following your passion and you really that's love right. what you're doing, it may not make the money that you expected, but you're going to be happy doing it.
Exactly.
Right. And maybe you need to make adjustments or stop doing it in the future, but it'll add. I mean, listen, just look at Marilyn's story from the very beginning through now. It's always been these big experiments. Just jump in and do it and see how it works. And the things that don't work, stop doing them. The things that, right? Meerkat.
That's right.
I'm looking around. Those things aren't working, or I can let those go and I could focus on those things and make those bigger and better and then do it again and again and again and again. So very powerful suggestion there. Very wise answer to that question, Marilyn. Marilyn's name is Marilyn Modinger. It's Moedinger. Marilyn Modinger. Runcible Studios with an S.com is the website. Go check that out. You can click the little shopping bag at the top right corner if you want to go right to the store from there. Or just go to runciblestudios.com/shop and go buy something. Go buy something right now.
Yes, please.
Don't care what it is. Buy one thing. And then take that link. I say this about the podcast every week. But take runciblestudios.com/shop and send it to a friend. One friend. That's it. Just one friend. So everybody who's listening, go buy something and then go encourage somebody else to go buy something. You can connect with Runcible Studios on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. You can just search for Runcible Studios. We'll have links in the show notes as well. Again, Marilyn's on Twitter, M.W. Modinger on Twitter. Marilyn, I value our friendship. You are a very important person in my life. And you and I have had many, many deep conversations separate from Entree Architect, separate from architecture. And I value your input in my life, being part of my life. You're an inspiration to me and to many, many people out there. Thank you for sharing your knowledge here today, but thank you for everything that you do for everybody that you do it for, because you are a very selfless person and you're working really hard at making the world a better place. And I appreciate you for that. And I appreciate you for sharing your knowledge today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much. So much, Mark. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to episode 348 with my friend Marilyn Modinger. How inspiring was that episode? If this is an episode that you would like to share with a friend, if you'd like to access the show notes, there is a link to be able to do that. EntreeArchitect.com/episode348. That is the link to share with a friend. Please do that. Share that right now. Pop that link, EntreeArchitect.com/episode348, right into an email and send that to a friend. Post it in Facebook. Tweet it out on Twitter. Do it in all the places. EntreeArchitect.com/episode348. And we will continue to grow this podcast so we can continue to serve the profession of architecture. Entree Architect is a proud member of the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media, curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at Gable Media. GableMedia.com, that's the place to check it out, at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership, ready to edit business resources. You might need those, right? Live monthly training every month, a new expert coming in and training for us, and a supportive architect community waiting for you. It's all waiting for you at Entree Architect Academy membership. Learn more and enroll right now at entrearchitect.com/join. Did you know it's free for 30 days? You can come in, check it out. You can even hang out with us at the live monthly training for free. 30 days. If you like it, stick around. If you don't, cancel your membership. No cost. entrearchitect.com/join. I hope to see you there. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, be happy, safe, and secure. Thank you for listening today to the Entree Architect podcast. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay. We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.